Well, we are talking again about the issue of a boy becoming a man. It may seem strange for some of you or hard because you may be a woman, you may be single, you may be a grandfather, you may have non-Christian children, non-Christian wife. Situations abound that create a question as to why we need a series like this, but we need it. We need it, as I've said repeatedly, because we have a ton of little guys in this church, and moms and dads need to know what to do with those little guys. We also need it because we have many young men, both married and unmarried, who may or may not have really thought through what it means to be a man. And in this day and age, that is something that is a critical need, far more than people are grasping, I believe. We need true men that withstand. For young ladies, this is the kind of man you should be praying for. This is the kind of man you should be looking for. They come in all shapes and sizes, but there are certain core things that ought to be present in a young man before you allow your heart to be taken away by him. Fathers, you should be looking at this when the guy comes a-knocking, as we said already. Does this man actually act as a man? Grandmas and grandpas, are you helping your children raise up young men, or are you hindering them? All of us, in some way or another, help. When we give a praise, or we rebuke or correct some little guy running by you, or when you're over at small group, or when you're just hanging with your friend who happens to have little boys, but you don't have any. What is it that we're doing? How are we pouring into the lives of one another? So it is with all of that that we want to consider what it means to be a man rather than simply a boy. Now, I've spent 2 weeks on the first point, which was spiritual maturity is needed that is sufficient to lead a wife and children. 2 weeks on that. It's critical that you grasp that one issue. If you get everything else right, but you fail there, as I said, you raise a nice, simple, good-looking, hard-working pagan. You must understand that a young boy is to be raised up in the gospel and in sound theology, not by mere word, but also by deed. They must see a mom and a dad who live out the word of God in a very practical sense, which is why we spent our last week, looking at those various passages that talk about our walk, our way of conduct in life, what it is that motivates us and drives us, learning to see that theology starts in our heart through the Word of God, but it works itself out very, very simply in our hands. And we need to make certain that our mouth and our hands and our feet mimic what we say we believe. Very, very important. When you don't do that, what you raise are ungodly children. Now, when you hear the term ungodly, you can immediately think, some wicked individual who's all over the map doing crazy things. But that is not the image the Bible portrays of being ungodly. Ungodly, at its simplest terms, means one who does not give thought to worship. Does not give thought to worship. A godly individual, the word, simply means one who has reverence for God and the things of God, thinks of God, dwells on God, is motivated by God, delights in God. Simply put then, when you have ungodly, all that means is it's a person who doesn't give a thought of God. They could be a really nice person, they just don't think about God. They don't consider the gospel, and they don't even think about how that applies in their life as they're growing up or as they're pursuing adulthood. They don't rest in the power of the Spirit. They don't think about God. That is what you don't want to do. So when you're raising a child and you're thinking, I want to raise up a young man who is spiritually mature, one who is able to lead his wife and his children, what I am saying to you is you want to raise up a godly young man. Someone who thinks about God and considers how God operates in and around and through our lives. Does that make sense? Very simple, huge issue, but very simple concept. Don't think of raising just a nice guy. You want to think about raising a young man who thinks about the Lord. And as you do that, you do it by modeling it. You have to do it because they see you think about the Lord. They see you talk about the Lord. They see you before God under His Lordship, living out your life. A father can be very busy being religious on Sundays, but fail to show that religion, if you will, or worship is everything. Everything you do. There's this false bifurcation, fancy word, splitting between the secular and the sacred. It's unbiblical. Everything is sacred. Everything is spiritual. Everything is worship. And as a father and as a mother, the better that you see that, the better you'll raise your children. You'll show them how then your food, your dress, your speech, the way you keep a house, the way you go about paying bills, the way you go about training or loving your wife or loving your husband, whatever is the issue, simply going to work, all of it is in fact genuine worship. And showing your child what that looks like raises a godly child. They begin to realize that God permeates everything, and so we need to be constantly aware that we are offering to God worship when we go to work, or when we talk, or relax, or rest, or sleep, or eat, or anything else. All of it is to be done to the glory of God. Now, alongside all of that, though, there are several other qualities that you want to pour into your boy. And all of these, well, not all of them, many of them will also apply to a young lady as well. So at this point, we're really just talking about child rearing. And this next step would be true as well. It is the spiritual maturity that is, I mean, a personal maturity that is sufficient to be a responsible, underline that word, responsible husband and father. The next step is having thought about how to place spiritual maturity into your young man. You want to think about personal maturity. Very broad umbrella idea. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul talks about the idea of being single and pursuing singleness. And it's actually a gift that some have been given. It is not something that someone has been afflicted with. It is something that they have embraced. In chapter 7, verse 32, Paul says, "But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world and how she may please her husband. And this I say to you for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is seemly and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord." Unless this is your son, meaning God has called him to a life of singleness and he wholeheartedly embraces it. I am not talking about singleness due to choices made in your life. I am talking about a decision, a concentrated decision that I will remain single for the purpose of completely devoting my life and my pursuits toward the Lord. Not allowing anything else to get in the way. It's not singleness so I can pursue my career. It's not singleness so I can save a lot of money. It's not singleness so I don't have to be hurt. Or it's not singleness because I don't trust anybody. It's singleness for the simple purpose that I don't want anything to distract me from my pursuit of the Lord and my service to the Lord. Unless a young man has that mindset, the typical trajectory, as I've already said, is toward marriage and toward children. They are to get married and they're supposed to have babies. That's just normal. And it's important that you understand that that's what you're raising in your little boy. There are no other options before men and women that God gives you. You either remain single and devoted to the Lord, or you get married and you remain devoted to the Lord as you lead your wife and you make babies. Simple. It is a task then of parents to raise up young men who are mature enough to do that. Doesn't that seem so obvious? And yet time after time after time, parents simply forget this. They get so caught up in the minutiae of life and the things that are just in front of them at that moment that they forget that eventually that little guy is not going to be little anymore. And all of a sudden, he's going to be looking at a young lady and you realize, oh my, it's time for him to get married. And you realize you have not done almost anything in his life to prepare him for that. That is not good. It's not right. That means then that you're pointing your son and your daughters, but your sons, toward that goal from day one, that it's just part of the way you live out your life and how you talk. My wife prayed for her daughters, and her son prayed and prayed and continues to pray for them. But she prayed that God might bless them with godly mates. We have sought in our own lives as mother and father, now on the back end of all of that, we sought to train our children from the earliest of days toward their respective roles as men and women. I ask only that you consider that. How often have you thought about why you're disciplining that son in that way, or why you discipline your daughter in that way? How you talk to them, what you do and portray within your home. In what way are you driving them and developing them toward the things that God has called them to be and in the manner that God has called them to be? That is hard work. It means that I trained my girls differently than I trained my son. And all of that requires so much faith. Because what you have is just that cute little girl coming out with her nightgown like my little Becca would do. She required very little entertainment. All you had to do is give her a gown, a nightgown that swirled out when you spun around. And she'd come out and she'd say, "Daddy, look." And then she'd twirl. And then she'd say, "Wasn't that beautiful?" And you just melt. You're like, yes, it was. And pretty soon the thumb's in her mouth and she's on the lap and life is good. But if you allow just that and forget that you're training a young woman, one day she's not a young woman, she's an adult woman. And it's time for her to marry, and you have not put into her the things that she ought to be a good wife and a good mother. You have to have eyes of faith that sees beyond what you have to what ought to be and what can be by the will of God. How many of you, as a mild rebuke, how many of you over the years have I recommended to buy the book Future Men? And yet so many it was purchased, but it remained unread. It always saddened me. People would say, "What, you know, is there something you'd recommend?" And I always recommended that book. It was a good book. It still is a good book. Not a perfect book, but it's a good book of raising up young men. And yet, time after time after time, the counsel was ignored, or it was partially heeded, just never read. Beloved, you have to be thinking about this all the time when you're raising a son. What happens to some fathers is that they blink and one day the son is not that little boy anymore. And they realize that time is incredibly short. And now they have to start chasing their son because they never were leading their son in the first place. It can be done, and it's not a futile process, but it is always better for those fathers here who are having little guys right now. Lead them now in the way of masculinity. Lead them now in the way of God and what it looks like so that they are used to following you and that you are always growing as a man yourself and putting things away so that they have an example of what godly manhood looks like. It is an important point to understand that the Bible does not paint childhood as the desirable place to be. Our society does, but the Bible paints childhood as something to get out of and to run from and to grow out of. Childhood is the place of immaturity and folly. Read the book of Proverbs, and you will find that to be abundantly clear, that what you are moving toward is wisdom and maturity. This is what is good and fitting and proper. You are not, or rather you are trying to grow your son or daughter into adulthood as quickly as possible, in other words. Does that not go counter to what you hear? I cannot tell you over the years how many times I've heard moms and dads who say, well, I just want them to have fun. And I'm like, your son is lazy. He doesn't need more fun. What he needs to do is figure out how to sweat and work and develop calluses and feel the strain of labor. He needs to know how to work, not have more fun. He's got that down really, really well. You are to raise up children that grow up quickly into adulthood, not slowly work their way into it with a 30-year plan in motion. Everything you do as a parent is not to be giving your children a fun life or letting them relax or tolerating massive time toward pleasure. It is toward growing. Growing in maturity, growing in strength, growing with their finances, growing in their spiritual world. Everything is to be growing, and you're supposed to be giving them an environment that promotes the growth. That's parenting at a simplest place. It's not merely sticking food in front of them and putting clothes on them and then basically disengaging yourself from their life. It is utterly engaging yourself into their life for the purpose of promoting that growth. It is noted right now in Britain that 1/5 of all the children in the households there have never, listen to this, have never seen a mother or father who wakes up as the norm, wakes up, showers, eats, and goes off to work. A massive number of people in that land simply receive unemployment and never work. In fact, they have found that it pays better to be on unemployment than in employment, and therefore they are raising multiple generations now of children who know nothing but unemployment as the norm. We lived in L.A., and we would watch the process of growing up. For me, part of growing up was Dad making me go to work and find a job early, early on and work hard and no excuses. It was just part of my life, and part of it was getting to drive. And in Idaho, and that was, those days, that was at 14. So I got to drive at 14 and learn that. And after that, it was go and get a job, and you better start working. I was going and working before then. In Los Angeles, we discovered many who their right of adulthood was their mom taking them down to the food stamp place, I don't even know what it's called, and showing them how to sign up for all of that. And that was the right of adulthood. It was learning to be dependent. This ought not to be. It is not the way we are called to be. Even if the government says it's right and it's good and we'll offer it, it is not right for us. Not as a Christian. We'll get into that in a few messages. You don't do that. You are to be training people. You're training your son that he can be spiritually mature enough and physically, personally mature enough that he can provide for that wife and provide for those children. This is how a boy must be taught. He must be taught to think in terms of marriage and family. That's what he's always going to be told. If he says, I don't want to get married, you want to instruct him in that and correct him in that. Unless he is such a unique young man that is so bent on pursuing merely God and his work and not one, in other words, having a gift of singleness, unless that's not true, or unless that's true of him, you should be correcting him when he says, I don't want to be married. Actually, you want to be married, and you will want to. And that's why I'm teaching you to act this way, son. And this is why I'm teaching you to speak in this way and to think in this way. So when you have a father who maligns and disrespects his wife, what you have is a shameful husband and a shameful man. Mike and I were golfing, and at the last hole, we ended up hooking up with two guys that were slow like us, and mostly slow like me, let's be honest. And we finished out the course with them. And on the ninth hole, we were at the Muni. Two young girls wearing shorts were walking up the sidewalk, and I glanced up and saw them. And those two guys, that they're my age, they're doing catcalls to the girls. And Mike and I are just standing there. And all I could think about was the shame of that and how these two men who have, if they've had children, have already raised them, basically view a woman as an object to humiliate and to use rather than to delight and protect. A father who treats his mother or his wife in a poor manner, disrespectful manner, unloving manner, is a shameful man, and he's instructing his children in the wrong way. The father who ignores the coming crisis for his son as that son enters adulthood and desires a young woman by never giving him wise counsel up to that point is a shameful husband or a father. The father who does not instruct his son in what a godly woman looks like is a man of shame. And I don't say this to be harsh. I just want you to grasp that your mouths, fathers, have to always be talking. Always talking, looking for any opportunity where God shows your child's heart, where you begin to see what's in that heart and how it operates. Mothers, the same way, that it's not just your child being tired. It's not just your child having a bad day, but his heart is being revealed. And it is an opportunity for you to shepherd then that heart. To raise a son to be a man who is unafraid to lead, who is capable of taking risks, who is willing to fight when necessary for what is right, both in the home and in society, and to be owning his own personal responsibility is a noble task. I'll talk about this more perhaps next week or the week after, but dads, don't let your sons give excuses. Young men, don't give excuses. Nobody wants to hear them. You think they want to hear them, but nobody does. Nobody cares. Just telling you the truth. Own it. In the military and in the police department, generally speaking, if I understand it with the military, I was never in it, but I certainly knew what it was in the police academy. When they gave you an assignment to do, no matter how stupid or how impossible, if you did not complete it, there was only one answer. No excuse, sir. No excuse. Once you take that into your life and you own that as a young man and you put that in your little boy and you don't let him come up with every excuse why he failed in this or that, even in the fun things. I never have minded a person who fails. It's the one who just doesn't try or just gives up. That it's like, you can't do that. Life is not that way. I remember being in track, and we were state champions, and you know, we took this very seriously. We loved to run, and we were in one race where I'll never forget it. It wasn't my teammate. It was one of the other teammates. I was first man, so I handed off, and I'm watching the rest of the race transpire. And the third man just decided to drop out of the race. And, you know, the final guy, he's waiting for the baton, and he's like, where's he at? Well, I just quit. I couldn't even grasp that. Even if we were killing them, I mean, they were already almost a full track length behind us. But you don't fit. I just don't get that. And I don't want my son to. I don't want him to be a young man who thinks of giving up. I want him to fight, 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 keep pressing on. Because when he's married and there's something in his home that's not right, I want him to be a man of substance that can stand with a backbone and fight. Fight for what ought to be. Not be a jerk, but fight for it. Fight for righteousness' sake. Stuns me the number of young people who won't vote. They won't fight within society. One of the greatest freedoms and gifts that were given in this society, and they just kind of shrug. It's like, what do you mean? Fight. Always fighting and willing to fight. Understand when you're raising boys that the family unit is always at the most basic unit in society. It's not singleness. It's not a city. It is not even children. What God created at the very beginning was a man, showed him that he was alone, then gave him a woman and said, this is good. This is very good. And this is what a son needs to see, is that it is not an undesirable thing, but a desirable thing to have a wife and to have children. So when a father delights in his family and delights in the training, do you hear that, young men? When a father delights in the training of his children in the ways of God, then good things are sure to come. Do you, fathers of young boys, delight in the task of training them? Do you see that as a gift from God? Or is it merely a burden that you seek to escape from? You own it. You own the responsibility to raise up your children and to put in them the things of God and the things that will make them a personally mature individual. A father who loves the gospel in his own life and loves to put it into the lives of his children is a wonderful man, a wise man. Listen, when we spanked our children, and we spanked our children, we did it to show them that sin is a lie. That sin has consequences. And that God is righteous and true. Spanking and physical discipline is not something to beat because I'm annoyed or frustrated or angry. That's not the purpose of it. It is to show that child at a very early age that sin never gives to them what they think it will give them. As I've said to parents on more than one occasion, when your son takes a cookie, make certain that the consequences of that theft is greater than the pleasure. Make certain that they file that away. Well, that wasn't worth it. Honestly, I have free cheap advice. Always make certain that you're putting into them that, so that when they're 25, they're not still trained in this thinking that lying, injustice, theft, or any other kind of activity like that is somehow acceptable if I gain pleasure from it. Because it is never right, and sin always lies. In the end, it always ends in death. We did this always to show them the idea of Proverbs chapter 15, where it says that the way of the lazy is as a hedge of thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. If you haven't written that one down, write that one down. Proverbs 15:19, the way of the lazy is as a hedge of thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. I quote it constantly. My children probably somewhat hate that proverb. But it's true. You watch your child, and if they go the way of laziness, they're just crawling deeper into the briar patch, and the thorns are gripping on them and cutting them and snagging them and tearing their clothes, and it's hard to move. It's just difficult. All of life is hard. And over here on the way of the upright is this broad highway that's just wonderful. Just go over there. And if you don't teach your child that, so that they see that every time they go the way of laziness or the way of sin, that all they are doing is climbing into the briar patch, then they will be foolish young men as they grow, and they'll just climb deeper and deeper into it. So teach them early and teach them often that the way of the lazy is a hedge of thorns, and the way of the upright is a highway. Never, never forget that one. Or Proverbs 14:12, that there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of what? Do you parent with that in mind? Do you parent your sons and daughters in that way? That there is a way that they will think is right, and that society will tell you is right, but its way is death. We did this. We did the training of our children, and the way we pursued it, we understood because our Father in heaven does it. In chapter 12 of Hebrews, I won't turn there, but it's sufficient for you to understand that he says that every son whom he receives, he scourges and disciplines. In fact, if you are not disciplined, you are not his child. And the purpose of this is so that when we are trained by it, it will yield its perfect, peaceful fruit of righteousness. It means that you have to endure the discipline, stay under the discipline, learn from the discipline, and out of it is this peaceful fruit of righteousness that God then produces in your life. You as a father are doing that to your sons and daughters. Most definitely you want to be doing that to your son. I would watch my wife discipline my son. And sons are tough, a lot tougher than moms think. I remember, you know, I heard her discipline him, and I came home from work, and I thought, all right, what's up? Walked down. He didn't see me, and he's crying, but I knew it was a fake cry. And guys are good at fake cries, moms. And Mom, Kim really thought she had done a good job. And I remember he stood up while she said, "And don't do that again." And he rolled his eyes. And I said, "Oh, ho." He went pale at that moment. He was just a little guy. But he had the ability to absorb much. So then I said, "I'll take over." And he didn't roll his eyes. No abuse there, guys. It was he's a little boy, tough. And Kim's like, "I really thought that I had done a good job." I'm like, "No, you didn't. That was tickle. He wasn't even remotely hurt." But he was crying. No, he wasn't. He was faking. So he's a boy. He's tough. Remember that. Remember that. Again, I'm not advocating that you beat the kid. But I'm also saying that you need to train the child so that he is able to learn from the consequences of his choices. That you're raising up a young man who is tougher than you realize and capable of that because God built him to be that way. A child never enjoys disciplines. But it is truly a work of grace in their life if you see it rightly. And you embrace that as part of your job. It doesn't mean that you become the father or mother. Whenever you come home, you just beat your kid because you figure they've done something to deserve it. It means that you're doing this with a very strong, clear purpose in mind to train into them that peaceful fruit of righteousness, just as your Father in heaven is doing it to you. Don't let your child determine that when they've been trained enough. Always determine that yourself. You're the one responsible to train them, not him. He doesn't get to put that decision. So let me give you some aspects of parenting. I understand and recognize that here I'm treading into your home. One of the things I've sought to do as a pastor is keep my nose out of your home as much as possible, except where the Word of God speaks to it. When I talk to fathers and mothers, but usually I talk to the father, it's his home, and I talk to them about their parenting, I've tried to come, and I hope that, and if not, you can please come and speak to me, but I've tried to come with that awareness that it is his home, not mine, and it is him who will give an account. And so I offer counsel, and that is the purpose of this aspect of my sermon. Please recognize it. Basic aspects of parenting a young man to become a responsible, mature adult. Bottom line, understand that child rearing is not something to be taken lightly, and the results will ultimately be known only after many years. That's why it's always a faith. But also understand that after many years, that son will be a billboard of you. That son will walk around portraying you. You're responsible for that. So start at an early age to have that so he rightly reflects those things that ought to be present. So first step in good parenting, especially good parenting of young men, is repent and reject that which was trained into you wrongly. The first step is you. Repent. Repent of those things that you got taught or shown by your parents wrongly. And all of us have failed. All of us have done things that ought not to be. Unless you were raised in an incredibly godly home, there are things that are simply wrong and unhelpful, and you need to allow for that. Some of you were raised in a home that was so ungodly that there is basically nothing there for you. We talk about this in premarital, about digging a well. And that's a great way for you to describe, or my way of describing parenting. All you do when you have a little cute kid who is smiling and giggling and they can't even crawl yet and you're just having so much fun with that little one, if you see that as the beginning of digging this well for that child so that when he is old, he has a wonderful, well-built well of wisdom that he can dip into at any point, you will do well as a parent. But it takes a long time. But some of you were raised in a home where you don't have a well. You can't ask, "What would my dad do?" Because whatever your dad would do, you shouldn't do. "What would my mom do?" I don't want to know what my mom would do. Some of you might be having to say. If your parents let you do whatever you wanted, demanded little of your time, then it will be a hard battle for you to overcome that. But you have to overcome that. You have to fight against that every step of the way. If you came from the opposite side, a harsh, legalistic, or violent home, then you have to resist the temptation to flee too far to the other side where you become too permissive. It's the same lie. It's just a different package. You have to say, what does the Bible say? And then go do it. Second point of counsel is make the marriage the center of the home and have Christ at the center of the marriage. Again, simple words, harder to do than you realize. Do not have a child-centered home, bottom line. It is not biblical and it is not wise. Many marriages sadly start to grow only after the children leave. The marriage is essentially put on hold while the babies are coming. And all we think about are the children. And then after all the children are gone, you look at each other and you realize, hey, you're still here. And that's when you start to figure out how to be married. And that ought not to be. 20 years later is not when you start to learn how to be a husband and learn how to be a wife that honors the Lord. Start that and hold on to that. Your children are to be shown the glory of marriage, the sanctity of marriage, and the joy of marriage. In every way, that should be your life. Lou Priolo gives several marks of a child-centered home. I'll just kick them off and make comments where I think are necessary. First one he puts as an evidence of a child-centered home is one that's so common, and that is they interrupt adults when they're talking. We had friends, the Ionosis, and we had them over to our house, and they had boys, all boys. In fact, one of their sons is a Navy SEAL, tough guy. And I remember these guys, they were over at our house, and we were thinking, you know, what nice boys they are, but they were boys, and we had girls, so it was fun to watch them run around. And I was talking to Tony, and one of his sons comes running up to him, and I saw him, and he put his hand on his father's arm. And I just stopped talking, and Tony's like, go ahead. I'm like, well, your son wants you. He says, I know. Go ahead. I said, well, it's a long story. Fine, go ahead. I'm like, okay. So I told him my story. The whole time I keep looking at this kid who's just standing there. Afterwards, he looks over at his son, yes. And his son asks him something. He says, absolutely, go ahead. And I'm like, okay, I want to learn that. I mean, that was cool. And he's like, why? He says, I don't want my child to think that it's his right to just come and interrupt. He needs to understand that to show respect for me and you, he doesn't interrupt. So we taught them to put their hand on my arm or the mother's arm and wait until we said yes. I thought, this is awesome. And we immediately implemented that into our home. And we have never regretted that once. It's just a simple way of teaching your child that there is a place and a way in which they interact with adults. When they use manipulation and rebellion to get their way, when they dictate family schedule, including meal times and bedtimes, when they take precedence over the needs of the spouse or have equal or overriding vote in all decision-making matters. My children had no vote, still don't have a vote. They might have a word of counsel, but it's my home. And the only person before God that will give an account for my home is me, not my wife and not my children. They demand excessive time and attention from parents to the detriment of other biblical requirements of the parent. Things that God says they are to be doing, but because you've allowed the children to so dominate, you're not able to do them. When you speak to children as though they are peers, when they speak to their parents as if they are equals, they're not. They're children. That they are the dominant influence in the home. When they are seen to be needing to be entertained and coddled rather than trained. Out of a bad mood. Keep the center, your marriage, in Christ. Third, realize that your children are supposed to leave, so train them that way. It is good for a son to get out of his house. Fathers, encourage them out. Kick them out if you have to, but encourage them out. You don't have to listen to me on these things. Again, counsel. But God has called young men to leave and to go find a wife. This is the idea. Husbands, I have to remind the mothers of that fact. Because moms instinctively want to keep those kids nearby. And you can understand that. But most definitely with boys, you want them trained always to think about getting out of the house, not staying at the house. It's good for them to get out. Little good is accomplished by letting the son live on and on in the home while he fiddles away. If he does live at home, at least make him work hard and give him large amounts of responsibility so that he begins to understand what it looks like to still have a household to care for. Boys are to leave and to find a mate. Women are to be given in marriage, and everything in your home should prepare him for that. That's what Genesis 2:24 means when it says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Teach them then to work at an early age and never make an apology for it. When they're complaining because you're dragging them someplace to go work, and everyone else's kid gets to play, don't give him any sympathy. He doesn't need it. He needs to work, and he needs to learn how to work. Make them save. Expect them to give to the Lord. Put those in their lives early. What we did with our children, again, is now with the child labor laws, it's ridiculous, but we found a place that would hire them at age 14. And at age 14, that's what we drug them to, and says work. And they would work, and then they had a savings account with either Kim or mine's name on it. And what they were required to do with that paycheck was they took the paycheck home, went with the parent to deposit it. They were allowed to keep 10% for whatever they wanted. Now, that's not much when you have a little paycheck, but they were allowed to keep 10% for whatever they wanted. They were required to give at least 10% to the Lord. They could give all of their paycheck. I remember a couple of times various children of my children at various times said, "I'd like to give my check." And I'm like, "Well, of course. Give the whole thing away." But they had to give 10%. That was not open for discussion. And then the other 80% had to be saved. The result is that all of them paid for their own college. And none of them has school loans. Not one. Their money was not for their pleasure. That's not what money is for you. Money was a tool. So put it in your children to work, labor, save, and give. Very, very simple. Fourth, never tolerate a complaining spirit. Never tolerate a complaining spirit. This shows itself in tantrums and arguments and whining. It's a terrible attitude. And it is a terrible sin. In number 16, the company of Korah were grumbling against the Lord and complaining. It is a very minor thing in our eyes, but God destroyed them and their households. Wiped them out. In chapter 12 of Numbers, Miriam and Aaron are grumbling against Moses, their brother. God afflicts Miriam with leprosy. In chapter 5, verse 9, James tells us that we are not to complain, for in this we act as a judge, and God will then judge us. Speaking to believers, he says, you are not to be complaining, because in that you are acting as a judge, and God will judge you. Don't tolerate that in your children, a complaining spirit, a whining spirit. Listen, it's not a bad thing so much to see the child whine. I expect that from children. But it's so troublesome when I watch the parent allow it. Does that make sense? It's one thing. I expect my little 3-year-old to be a 3-year-old. That's what they are. They need to grow and they need to learn. But when mom and dad let them stay in that state and they're not corrected, that breaks my heart. Because I know at some point later on they're going to have to do it, and it will be all the harder to do. Listen, at some point in a person's life, they have to learn to accept things that are unpleasant. I've said this to many a father and mother when their child can't sit still. When are you going to teach him? And they're like, well, he's a little boy. I'm like, I know, and he's a little boy who needs to learn how to sit still. Well, he's too little for that. He's ADD. He's this, he's that. No, he's just a little guy who needs to be taught. What we did was he started out for like 5 minutes on the couch, and we had this time, it was just training time. And we put the kids on the couch with their little golden books and say, you're going to sit here on the couch, say nothing for 5 minutes. And then Kim was there, and if they crawled off the couch before the 5 minutes were up. They got a simple discipline, put back on, say, you're going to sit for 5 minutes. And we kept extending that until pretty soon they could sit through the entire church service with John MacArthur preaching. It was a long service. But we were teaching them how to just simply have that self-control. If you don't want to do it at 2, is it at 5 that they have to will learn? If it's not at 5, will it be at 15? If it's not at 15, when do your children finally learn to sit? When do they learn not to complain? When do they learn to accept that life isn't fun, that life is hard, that life cheats you, life does you wrong? My son and my daughters are not allowed to just launch. They have to understand that's how the life works. But that means then, dads, that you have to have control over yourself, that you can't be a grumbler. You establish that standard in grace. You don't put it on your children. And at the core of that is a recognition that God is sovereign. And in all of this, God is at work. You can ache for your child when things are unfair. And you can share with them that frustration and sadness, but you can't tolerate that bitterness. In chapter 1 of James, he talks about trials in a very positive way. He says in chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, consider it nothing but joy, literally, consider it nothing but joy, my brethren, when, not if, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let the endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Your son comes home, stupid school, or I hate my job, those people are idiots. Well, they probably are idiots, I'll accept that. But welcome to life, buddy. It's only going to get worse. Wait until you see what corporations are like. Yeah, I remember talking to Nicole when she got her first real job, what I call a real, real job. And I said, it's amazing that that company is actually a Fortune 500 company, isn't it? She's like, I know. I said, you just are amazed at how many idiots actually exist. And yet, business still progresses somehow. But if you teach your children that in the midst of that trial, God is at work, and that they are to have a different mindset than, it's unpleasant, I don't like it, you will raise up a child who is ready to enter into life. Start them young thinking this way, that God is at work in the midst of trials. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6, he says in a different way, and he addresses the issue of trials. In chapter 1, verse 6, he says, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now, for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. What is the thing that you are rejoicing in? He says, in this. What you're rejoicing in is what verses 3 through 5 speak about. The fact is that God has saved you, that Christ has redeemed you, that you have an inheritance that will never pass away, safe in heaven waiting for you, and that you yourself are protected by the power of God. He says, in the midst of that, rejoice. Because in this life, in this world, in this age, trials come. Things that cause distress come. People die. Sickness comes. Famines come. All kinds of stuff comes. And if you look at those things for your joy and your hope, then you will be constantly swept around like the sea. But once you get past that and you train your son to think beyond the here and now and to the not yet, then in that he can greatly rejoice, and all of a sudden you create this anchor for his soul. And he starts to grow toward manhood as a firm young man, rather than one who is swept around by every changing thing. That's what you teach your children. Look beyond the now, and look to the one who is eternal, and the one who offers eternal life through Jesus Christ. It's that simple, every day, thinking that way. At the same time, if you've tolerated this kind of attitude of complaining for some time, if your children are really good at complaining, then you need to sit down with them, have a family meeting, and explain to your children your sin for tolerating it. A family meeting just simply saying, hey guys, I failed. And I've allowed you guys to be bitter and complaining. No more. I'm going to let you know what's going to happen, and you'll lay that out, and the consequences and the reality, but you'll show that and explain it so there's no shock of wondering why. But be faithful and consistent with it. Fourth, understand the heart of your child. It's a heart that's dead in sin and in rebellion to the Lord. That's what you have in that cute little cradle. Understand it. It's not innocent. All of humanity is under the curse of sin and the power of sin. Romans chapter 5 makes this abundantly clear that we are sharers in our father's sin, Adam. And we need to look to the second Adam, Jesus Christ, for salvation and forgiveness. Understand your heart of your child, but understand also this. Though it is dead in sin, it is also a heart that is naive, and that's good. We call it innocent, but that's not really what it is. It's just naive. A child is not born doing as much evil as it possibly can. That gets taught. You have a little one who is sensitive and trainable and moldable, that you can pour the grace of God into their life, the gospel of Christ into their heart. You can show them how to act and to live. And when you do that with sincerity and love, that child really just blossoms in a wonderful way. So understand that you have a child dead in sin, but it's a naive heart as well, and you're to train that heart and teach it. To do this, however, requires that you have them under your control. Hear me on this. Not under your fist. Not under your fist. Under your control. Where they listen to your voice and you're able to direct them. When a child throws a fit, yells, screams, refuses to listen, that is a child who is out of control, moms and dads. Don't tolerate it. You will never speak to them into their heart if you cannot first get them to hear you. If they're always running around, screaming, fighting, kicking, whatever, then you're losing your child. So you teach them early on to have self-control. Grace needs to abound in your home as parents because you're raising sinful children as a sinner yourself. But grace makes no sense to a child if first he has not been taught what it looks like to obey and what happens when you disobey. Grace is something that you show your child that after you've taught them to have control and then you withhold the discipline, they understand that they should be disciplined. But out of grace, you chose not to and you speak to them. If all you do is consistently withhold the disciplines and training your child, what you do is you teach your child actually contrary to what you're hoping for. Understand also the simplicity of child rearing. In Ephesians 6, he tells us how to raise a kid. In Ephesians 6, verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first command, with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Listen, the New Testament simply gives you two commands for child rearing. Just two. Not hard at all. First, your children are to obey. And second, they're to show respect. Obey and respect. That's it. If you get those drilled into your own mind, that the first thing I want to see is a child that will obey me, and secondly, one that will respect me, then all of your decision making will be very, very simple in your home. The first command is obey your parents. It's not an option. It is the expectation. Or at least it should be. I watch far too many parents over the years who assume otherwise. I watch them get all tense and worried because pastor's at their home. And they're nervous because they know their children are not going to obey. They should be at rest. They should recognize two things. One, their child will not obey. Two, that they expect them to obey. And when you see that, then you see the father who is relaxed. When his kid goes screaming across the room, you know, just demolishing everything in his path, if you see a calm father who then stops his son, corrects his son, and then allows the house to go on, that's a beautiful thing. You want to expect your children to obey, and you act accordingly. Assuming they understand your directions, the answer is very easy to determine, are they obeying me? That's all you have to ask yourself is, when you see your child doing something, ask yourself, is he obeying my direction? Not hard, is it? Jason, go mow the lawn. Now, all I have to ask is one thing when I see Jason. What is it? Is the lawn mowed? Lawn's not mowed. Jason is now disobedient. Unless he's bleeding. So I deal with him. It's just that simple. So you expect your child to obey. So by the way, you don't give him direction if you have no intention of following up on that. How we operated in our home was this. Did my child respond in obedience? Or was it one of fighting, arguing, whining, moaning, spitting, yelling, throwing things, kicking, and the myriad of other ways that our children were gifted in showing rebellion? They were normal children. And we only had to ask, did they obey? If they did not obey, we disciplined. We taught them to learn to obey. And we did that at an early age so that by the time they were very young, most of their disciplines were gone. We didn't need to because they were under control and now we could speak to them and chew them out. From 10 on, most of them, were done with disciplines of any type. It was now verbal rebukes. Now, we hardly even do that. I mean, they're all adults. It's almost completely counsel. But it was done faithfully and consistently. It was not done with favoritism. It was not winking at what God calls sin. It was, we take this serious. So, first question and first issue in child rearing is, you teach your child to obey. Second, you teach them to show respect. Now, all of this as under the Lord and in the Lord. In other words, this is what it looks like in a Christian home to live. We do this in the Lord and we do it under His Lordship. So you obey your mom and dad because that's what God calls you to do. This is good. You also expect them to respect you. And we extended that respect, which should also go outward toward other people and other things. So in everything we asked them, it was an issue of respecting. Instead of making a million rules that we would never remember, we taught our children to respect us and then branched out there to respect others. So here's how it would work. I've watched parents who see their kids in the kitchen banging the pans together and making a joyful noise. And you say, no, you don't bang pans. And you take them from them and you tell them that's a no and that's done. The next day they're banging glasses together. No, you don't bang glasses together. You don't bang this. You don't bang that. And it's just rule upon rule upon rule. This is what we told our children. One, they were never allowed in our kitchen because it was a dangerous kitchen, very old, rickety stove. And so when mom was in cooking, they knew they were not allowed to come in, even one finger, because they all would put the finger. You would watch them crawl right up to it, and mom would say, hey, you stay out there. And they'd look and boink. And you're like, you little. And they would get disciplined for it because we're laughing, but it's not cute. It's evil. Right? It's wrong. It's just rebellion. I'm going to push it. And you have to show them, no, it's not the way of righteousness. That's not obedience. But we never had to teach our children to leave this thing alone and that thing alone, because if it was not theirs, it was disrespectful to touch it. Now, trust me, I pulled more items out of our VCR than I care to think of. So this was not perfect. But it was really nice because we could take them to a people's house and they'd watch four little guys come into their home and the poor older people are looking at all their things and they're already picturing everything broken. And we would just simply say, listen, you know, where would you like our children to play? And they'd say, oh, well, over there, that would be great. Okay, is there anything that they're not allowed to touch? And, you know, the wife's like, yeah, that whole wall, you know. It's like, all right. But I'd take all four of my kids right up there. I say, kids, this is a no. A no. Show me your no. They all point. All right. Okay, you can play here. And they'd have their toys and they'd play. And they would never touch the stuff. Because they had been taught that that would be disrespectful. See, it wasn't any more than that. It was just it would be disrespectful. You're not respecting mom when you bang her pots. You're not respecting dad when you break his tools. You're not respecting anybody. And so learn to respect. Grant them honor. And once you do that, it becomes very helpful. A young man who does not show respect is a young man who is shameful. When he is taught, though, how to show respect and what that looks like, then he is one who is on his way to a life of godly maturity, to show respect. You want to get on my bad side as a young man, be disrespectful. You know, I just have no time for it. When I'm working and you're sitting, that's never good. Remember Maddie? I may have told you the story. We went to Cameroon. And I had paid that out of my own pocket, so it was an expensive trip for me to take him there. But I wanted him to see a third world. I wanted him to experience what I had experienced. And when we were there, we were with Mr. Michaelis and Mr. Love, and we were with my friend, Philemon, in his home. And I wanted him to be there, and I told him, I don't want to catch you playing games, because they had a video game thing. I said, I don't want you doing that. And I told him, because I came back from the class the first day from teaching, and when I came, I saw, I think it was Glenn, in the backyard working on something. And I came in and found my son in the house sitting. And I said, what are you doing? And he's like, nothing. I said, get your rear end up right now. Stand up. And, you know, he's at this point has no idea why I'm angry. I said, get over here. Why? I said, do you think I paid $1,800 to have you sit in a house? I said, Mr. Michaelis is in the backyard working. Never let me catch you ever sitting when a man is standing and working. Do you understand me? You get out there and you find out how you can help him. And don't sit until he sits. And you make certain you're the second one sitting. I'm proud of my boy. He took that perfectly, went out there, and the rest of the time there, he was always with. If there was a man working, he was right next to him. I said, you are to work with these men. You disrespect them when you let them work and you fiddle away. Young man, never, never, never let that happen. I remember watching my secretary, Judy, walking. I came around the corner and there was three or four young men standing in the lobby. And I see her. She had just gone to Sam's and she's got her arms filled with stuff and she's trying to get to the door. They're all standing with their hands in their pocket watching her. Oh, did I launch on them. Get out there. Open that door. Take those things from her hands. What are you doing? Show respect. What I had was young men who had not been trained to show respect and to honor. Again, you have to model this. A father and a mother who show respect as well. In verse 4 of Ephesians, he says this, "And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." In Colossians, he says, "It's you're not to exasperate your child." Listen, it's easy to focus everything on the child, but it's a serious error, for they're only children. Remember that. It's similar to the error of focusing on a wife submitting rather than a husband loving her as Christ loves the church. Both the child and the wife are in positions of weakness, and you have to understand that. They are not to be exploited, but to be guarded, cherished, and protected. For the little one, you're training them. We have to understand that there's a difference between provoking your child to anger and seeing your son become angry. We'll talk about that next week, Lord willing. But to treat your child harshly with inconsistency or favoritism is evil. It's sin. Fathers, you are to be a good expression of what the Heavenly Father looks like, and He doesn't exasperate any of us. And so next week, I hope to talk about what it means to not provoke your child to anger and not to exasperate it. But let me give it to you really simply in a couple of sentences. The easiest way to exasperate your child is to not train your child. So on Monday, you're tired, and so son has to shut up and just be quiet. That's the rule. But on Tuesday, you're in a good mood, so son's allowed to talk. On Wednesday, he has to clean his room because your wife has been bending your ear on it so much that you're sick of it, so you make him clean his room. But on Thursday and Friday, he doesn't have to clean his room because you guys are all in good moods, and so now he's allowed not to. That is exasperating because he never knows on day-to-day what the rules are. He doesn't know how to operate. Think about what it would be like at your job. If you're yelled for something on day two that you were praised for doing on day one, you just start to go crazy. That's the simplest way to kill the heart of a child. have a faithful, godly, Christ-centered home that's consistent, and you will raise up a fine young man.